Medicine has made great advances, but it also has some blind spots. Dogma may persist despite new evidence. This is The People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Dr. Marty McCary is a renowned surgeon at Johns Hopkins University. He's also a medical muckraker.
His new book is titled Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
When we issue recommendations in medicine based on good scientific evidence, we shine as a profession. We help a lot of people. But when we make recommendations based on dogma and a gut feeling, we have a lousy track record.
Coming up on The People's Pharmacy, unmasking the myths of modern medicine.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, microscopic particles of plastic have been found in many parts of the human body. Now scientists announce that they've found microplastics in brains. Specifically, investigators report that autopsies of 15 individuals revealed microplastic shards in the olfactory bulbs of 8 of them. This location suggests that tiny bits of plastic could get into the brain if they're in the air we breathe. The autopsies identified 16 different plastic particles or fibers. The researchers note that nanoplastics, particles that are even smaller and harder to detect, might be present in greater numbers. Neuroscientists don't know yet whether the accumulation of plastic in the brain could affect cognitive function, but they worry about the potential for the chemicals in plastic to disrupt brain health.
Another way plastic compounds get into our body is through food packaging. A new study points out that 14,000 chemicals migrate into food from items used in processing, packaging, storing, and serving it. The investigators found evidence that 25% of the known food contact chemicals can be detected in the human body. Some of these are considered worrisome because they're endocrine disruptors. The lead author of this study recounted an anecdote in which she was offered a meal on a flight. The salad dressing was served in a small plastic container. Remembering that plastic compounds leach more easily into fats or acidic foods, she decided to forego dressing on her salad.
Flavonoid-rich foods appear to be good for the brain. That's the conclusion from a study of almost 122,000 participants in the UK Biobank. These volunteers, from 40 to 70 years of age, were recruited between 2006 and 2010. At that time, they answered detailed questions about their dietary habits. After 9 years, the researchers determined who had been diagnosed with dementia and calculated how genetics, blood pressure, and depression affected the risk, as well as the amount of flavonoids in the diet. The highest levels of flavonoids were found in the diets of people consuming 2 of the following daily: 5 cups of tea, 1 glass of red wine, or half a serving of berries. The people who consumed the highest amount of such flavonoid-rich foods were at substantially lower risk for developing dementia. Those at higher risk benefited the most.
There was a time when doctors frequently prescribed benzodiazepines such as diazepam, lorazepam, or alprazolam to help people fall asleep. These days, use of such hypnotics for long periods of time is discouraged. That's because long-term use can contribute to falls, cognitive impairment, car crashes, and frailty in older individuals. Researchers wondered if people could wean themselves off these sleeping pills even if they suffered from insomnia. They compared 3 approaches that included 2 different mailed interventions to no intervention. The volunteers were nearly 1,300 older adults in New Brunswick, Canada. One intervention had booklets on how to stop sleeping pills and how to get your sleep back with a focus on cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. The other included booklets called You May Be at Risk and How to Get a Good Night's Sleep Without Medication. After 6 months, 46% of those getting the first information packet had stopped their benzo use or lowered the dose by at least 1/4. That number was 35% for those getting the second information packet, and 20% for the control group getting no intervention. The investigators conclude that a simple, scalable, direct-to-patient intervention can help reduce benzo use and improve sleep outcomes.
Atrial fibrillation is a rapid, irregular heart rate that can increase the risk of stroke. For decades, doctors thought it affected more than 3 million American adults. A new study of 30 million people receiving health care in California indicates that almost 5% of us actually have AFib, as it's known. That amounts to 10.5 million adults around the country. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. A few years ago, we bought a new car. One of the most wonderful safety features it has is blind spot detection. When a car is passing you and it's in your blind spot, there's a flashing light on the relevant side mirror to warn you not to move into that lane.
Kind of a shame, Terry, that we don't have blind spot protection for other areas of life.
Well, we really need such a system in healthcare.
To tell us why, we're talking with Dr. Marty McCary. He is the chief of islet transplant surgery at Johns Hopkins University. His most recent book is Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
Welcome back to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Marty McCary.
Great to be with you.
Dr. McCary, we are thrilled to be able to talk to you about your new book, Blind Spots. But I guess the question that immediately arises for me is that you have a background in gastrointestinal surgery, so you are at heart a surgeon. How in the world did you become a medical muckraker, revealing what I would call flaws in medical dogma and, you know, really promoting transparency? How did all that happen?
Well, thanks for asking. I have always had an interest in the entire system, the entire body, but we don't have a specialty for that. It's family medicine doesn't exactly capture what I'm referring to. It's not alternative medicine, although it includes alternative options. It's not holistic medicine, although it is holistic. It's not just functional medicine, although it includes that. It's how we fund research. It's the FDA's backwards way of doing things. It's the entire connectedness of every cell in the body through mechanisms of general inflammation, mitochondrial health, insulin resistance, food as medicine. So we don't have an education for that. And I think it's healthy to be thinking globally. And that's how I've always wanted to sort of focus my career.
Well, we agree. We've always been alarmed and dismayed at the silos that tend to exist in medicine, so that the gastroenterologists generally don't have any idea of what the other consequences of some of the medications they prescribe might be.
Well, you know, it reminds us a little bit of what we call groupthink and the idea that, you know, once people get attached to something like proton pump inhibitors, acid suppressors, you know, they're like the greatest drugs.
And we shouldn't just be picking on the gastroenterologists. Every specialty in medicine does this.
So how did you get out of that mold? How did you begin to look more holistically?
Well, it was very apparent to me early that we do have these silos that you're describing, and a lot of things don't fit in the system. There's no silo for the microbiome, for food, for talking about school lunch programs. Instead, it's just talking about Ozempic and medications and this sort of reflex. And I remember telling my dad stories of what I was observing in medicine with this incredibly siloed culture, where you're basically given this anatomy book in your first day of medical school and repeatedly hammered this question into you, which organ are you going to pick as your focus? And we celebrate these doctors who are super subspecialized in one little tiny subspecialty of an area. And I did that. I got my subspecialty in surgical oncology and gastrointestinal surgery. But I felt like something was missing. So I went to public health school, and I've been trying ever since to ask the big questions. There's so many things in healthcare that we are not talking about that we need to be talking about. And those are the blind spots you're referring to.
Now, Dr. McCary, you've written that dogma, groupthink, and the suppression of scientific debate describe the culture of the modern medical establishment. That's what we've just been saying. How did we get here?
Well, I think it's part of the human condition. We tend to believe what we hear first, not because it's more logical or has more scientific support, but simply because we heard it first. And this gets to what you referred to with people latching on to PPIs. It's not just PPIs, it's hair care products. They're absolutely convinced that this one product is the only product that will optimize their appearance. And so not only do we see that with medications and opioids and things like that, but also in medical dogma. Now, there's a scientist in psychology in the 1960s who described this very perfectly. He described cognitive dissonance. That is, the human mind only likes to believe one thing. And if something else conflicts with that belief, we tend to, in a very passive subconscious way, dismiss the new idea or reframe it to actually fit what we already believe. But we don't want to let go of what we believe. That really goes against the basic principle of science. And people who are objective and can, as Dr. Claude Bernard, the founder of modern medicine, described, temporarily suspend your prejudices. Recognize we all have biases. Actively recognize that, and then actively suspend those biases as you consider new information so you can be impeccably objective. You see this fallacy in politics, in business, and in science as well. So we have to recognize this human tendency that Dr. Leon Festinger described, or else we can be succumbed to the sort of herd mentality in the way we think as well. And the purpose of science is to challenge deeply held assumptions in the field. So that's why we need to recognize these tendencies of the human mind.
Well, you know, what fascinates me is the story, and you mention it in your book, about Dr. Semmelweis. Can you give us a very quick overview of why he is such a great example of this problem?
So Dr. Semmelweis was a physician in Hungary who was assigned a clinic and noticed that the infection rate in that clinic was sky high. And then another clinic where he had practiced had a very low infection rate. Well, it turns out that the doctors in the hospital, in the clinic with a high infection rate, were not washing their hands between baby deliveries that they were performing. And at the same time, they were going down to the cadaver lab to do instruction and learning and things like that. It was very obvious to him that infections were being spread by the physicians. But at the time, in the 1800s, that was heresy. You know, physicians couldn't be spreading infections. So he started a protocol to wash hands. But only one of the hospitals where he eventually worked did it. The doctors found it so offensive that they would be told to wash hands. And eventually, Semmelweis was essentially deemed a mentally insane person, put in a facility like a state penitentiary, and died in the penitentiary. This sort of miserable death, all for asking physicians to wash their hands.
And it took actually quite a long time for doctors to embrace washing hands generally.
Yeah, we have so many scientific discoveries in medicine, not just Semmelweis's discovery of the germ theory affecting what they called childbed fever at the time. But today, there are remarkable discoveries in medicine that do not get the light of day because they don't fit into one of the big NIH silos. They are not at the core of one specialty.
For example?
Well, so in my opinion, the microbiome is the perfect example of an organ system that is connected to every organ system in the body, but it doesn't have a specialty. It doesn't have an NIH center. Here's what we're learning about the microbiome. It not only is involved in digestion, it produces enzymes and vitamins. It trains the immune system. It produces serotonin, involved in mood and the brain. It can regulate estrogen, and it can even produce GLP-1 in low doses. So here's an incredible garden of bacteria that we have no idea really how it works, but we're starting to recognize that when you give antibiotics, you're carpet bombing the microbiome. When you're born by C-section, the baby's microbiome, which is sterile in utero, is not seeded with the bacteria from the birth canal. It's the baby's extracted from a sterile operative field, and the baby's microbiome may be seeded by the bacteria that normally live in the hospital. Now, antibiotics and C-section save lives, but they're massively overused, and it's impacting the microbiome. And it may be why we're seeing newborns now that are obese, because the microbiome we know is spread generation to generation. We've also heard stories of people exercising like crazy and they can't lose weight or changing their diet. There may be something going on with the microbiome. The most significant study that of the last 10 years, in my opinion, was a study I discovered in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, where they looked at kids who had taken an antibiotic in the first few years of life and compared them to matched children who did not take an antibiotic in the first few years of life. Kids who took an antibiotic in the first few years of life, in this large study of 14,000 kids by the Mayo Clinic, they had a 20% higher rate of obesity, a 21% higher rate of learning disabilities, a 32% higher rate of attention deficit disorder, a 90% higher rate of asthma, and nearly a 300% increased risk of celiac. We are altering the microbiome in ways that we don't understand. All these chronic diseases are going up in the modern era of antibiotics and C-sections. And this study is the first real signal in the data to say, hey, there may be an association there. We really need to look carefully at this and teach people about the appropriateness of care, not just the reflex to treat everything we see. We have the most medicalized generation in the history of the world. We have got to stop and reexamine what we're doing.
You're listening to Dr. Marty McCary, Chief of Islet Transplant Surgery at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. McCary's most recent book is Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
After the break, we'll find out why cardiologists embraced margarine instead of butter.
Despite a lack of evidence, doctors warned people that eating eggs would raise cholesterol.
Why did mainstream medicine reject the idea that bacteria cause stomach ulcers at first?
Barry Marshall ultimately got the Nobel Prize for that research.
Does funding reinforce blind spots?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by CocoVia Dietary Supplements. September is Healthy Aging Month. Why not take care of your heart and brain health by adding cocoa flavanols to your daily routine for cardiovascular and cognitive support? Consider how CocoVia can be a part of your routine to age well for better years to come. More information at CocoVia.com.
Today, our topic is blind spots in medicine. How do they affect healthcare?
We're talking with Dr. Marty McCary. He's the Chief of Islet Transplant Surgery at Johns Hopkins University and author of Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
Dr. McCary, in your book Blind Spots, you describe being invited to give grand rounds at Johns Hopkins. And this is an important talk, usually given by somebody who has something important to say to a medical department. And, it's prestigious to be asked, and it's usually great for the people who attend and listen and learn. But you had to fill out beforehand a set of forms. And one of the boxes you checked on this set of forms kind of got the attention of the administrators. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so these were standard forms you're supposed to fill out before giving any lecture for continuing education. And the grand rounds I gave at my hospital, Johns Hopkins OBGYN department, required this form. And the form said, you agree that you will be only saying things that are conform to generally accepted standards. And I answered, no. I mean, the purpose of most of our research is to challenge the deeply held assumptions in medicine and to use the scientific method. So this kind of this culture of obedience where, you know, you're not going to challenge any of our dogma or assumptions in the field, are you? I felt obligated to just answer it honestly. And it created a bit of an uproar of, you know, dozens of emails and back and forth. And did he fill this out wrong? Was it a mistake? And I basically told them, I'm being honest. If you want me to make up something and just put yes, you've got the wrong guy. And this is part of the problem. And this is actually the topic of my Grand Rounds presentation, why we should be challenging the dogma that hormone replacement therapy in postmenopausal women causes breast cancer when the data never supported it, challenging the dogma of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and so many other dogmas. This is how we need to get people to think, not to just do small, little, tiny scientific discoveries that the NIH rewards with grants. Those are small, incremental little things. And if you look at our overall return on investment from NIH research funding, it's pretty pathetic. I mean, we've made very few advances. So we've got to think big. We need Ben Franklin thinkers, not just people making small, little, incremental studies.
You know, I love examples, and I think our listeners really appreciate them to really help them understand the point you're making. Why don't we start with those dietary prohibitions on fat and cholesterol? Remember when we weren't supposed to eat eggs?
That's right. So the dogma that, and by the way, there's tons of this dogma. We got the food pyramid and fat wrong for 60 years. We got peanut allergies wrong for 17 years. We got opioids being non-addictive wrong for 30 years. We got hormone replacement therapy wrong for 22 years, still get it wrong. So what are we getting wrong today? We have to ask these questions. And specifically, you're asking about the dogma that fat is the demon of modern, the Western civilization. This has probably been the number one health recommendation by physicians in the last half century, is to avoid natural fats. And it turns out we got it perfectly backwards because there is no data to support it. It was popularized by a guy named Dr. Ansel Keys in the 1960s. He put out basically research that was done so poorly, you should not be making any conclusions from it. Then there were three gigantic studies done, massive randomized controlled trials and cohort studies to once and for all prove that eating natural fats in the diet causes heart disease. But all three studies failed to show an association. One of them actually showed that those on a low-fat diet had a higher rate of fatal heart attacks. The data sort of went the opposite direction from what the researchers expected, so they suppressed the study for 16 years. Somebody asked the lead investigator, why didn't you publish these data for 16 years? He said, well, it just didn't turn out the way we expected. So they've tried over and over again to demonize natural fat without any scientific proof that it drives heart disease. Now we know what drives heart disease is refined carbohydrates, sugars not bound to fiber like in natural fruits and vegetables, and probably the ultra-processed foods driving general body inflammation.
Well, I remember growing up, and I'm pretty old, so this was back in the 60s, my dad was told, your cholesterol is too high, and you need to not eat butter, and you need to not eat eggs. And so for decades, for, you know, probably close to 50 years, he avoided eggs. and he used margarine instead of butter. And, you know, he did live to be 97, but I think he might have lived that long even if he had enjoyed his eggs.
Well, you know, this brings up another issue because we are for a moment talking about heart disease. You know, there was a time when if you went to see a cardiologist for whatever reason and they did some kind of a scan and they could see a little narrowing in one or two of your coronary arteries, you would be a heart attack waiting to happen and be rushed as fast as possible to get a coronary bypass operation and or now a stent. And then they discovered what exactly and how has that changed?
So that was the era of cardiac stents, and that was a golden era of medicine. Millions of dollars were made and hospitals expanded on the profits. And everything was going great until one inconvenient truth was discovered in a well-done randomized controlled trial called the COURAGE trial. Stents do not improve survival unless you're having an active heart attack. Now, they can reduce the symptoms of angina, but the idea that having a stent increases your survival was just not true because you're adding a thrombotic risk. That is, the stent can get a stenosis in the stent. So that's why cardiac stents are way down in America. But why didn't we do that study at the beginning? And if you look at the flawed recommendations on so many things, if we would have issued a very good study before putting out a recommendation to the broad public with such absolutism, when it was really just based on opinion, we could have prevented a tremendous amount of harm that's been done and is still being done because most people still believe in the old medical dogma, even sometimes within the medical profession.
You do an interesting review of a bunch of medical ideas that were rejected when they came along. And I'd like to ask you about a few of them. Barry Marshall, for example, who was interested in ulcers. What can you tell us about him?
So Barry Marshall was a scientist in Australia who had read some papers from a long time ago suggesting that peptic ulcer disease or stomach ulcers were not caused by stress, as was the dogma of the modern era, but in fact caused by a particular type of bacteria called H. pylori, and it can be eradicated. And so what he did is he did an experiment where he induced an ulcer giving himself the H. pylori, drinking the H. pylori bacteria, and then curing himself with eradicating the bacteria with a very specific antibiotic. And this discovery, he did a lot of research studies and went to submit it to a medical meeting for the medical establishment to learn this incredible breakthrough. And he was told, I'm sorry, your paper was not selected for publication or for presentation at the meeting. We had 67 abstracts and we could only accept 56 of them. In other words, he was in the among the 10 that did not get accepted for the conference. He went on to win a Nobel Prize because this was one of the most important discoveries in modern history.
You talk a little bit about what I'll call medical tribalism. And you talk about peer review and that whole process when it comes to research studies, which seems like a really great thing. I mean, I've always been a big supporter of peer review and randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials, but it does seem like the system is very quick to reject new ideas, like Barry Marshall's idea of what causes ulcers. And I'm thinking a little bit now about Alzheimer's disease. There has been, for the last several decades, the amyloid theory of Alzheimer's, which means that pharmaceutical companies have sunk literally billions and billions of dollars into drugs that will suck up amyloid, that is to say, get rid of it from the brain. And yet none of these drugs have really been revolutionary in terms of their ability to reverse this disease, even though they get rid of amyloid quite effectively. Now there's another theory that's been floating around for about 40 years and has been pretty much completely rejected, and that's the idea of an infection as a possible cause or contributor to dementia. Maybe viral infections like herpes or even varicella zoster. What does it take to get the establishment to get over its what I'll call medical tribalism?
So you're seeing the groupthink play out. And with the amyloid hypothesis, I think it's interesting. I think it's partly true. But you see this incredible tunnel vision take place where now it's a race to develop these billion-dollar drugs to reduce amyloid. And the blind spot is, hey, look at the research that is not being discussed, that stress increases amyloid, that a lack of quality sleep affects your amyloid levels because your body is not removing amyloid normally in the deep stage of sleep where we know the lymphatic system of the brain will sort of vacuum up the amyloid plaques. There are studies showing that the Mediterranean diet reduces the risk of Alzheimer's. Estrogen in postmenopausal women reduces the risk of cognitive decline by 50 to 60%, and in one study reduced the risk of Alzheimer's by 35%. So here we have some very clear signals in the data on how to prevent Alzheimer's, but instead, all we talk about are the billion-dollar drugs that barely work and have a lot of side effects to treat Alzheimer's. And this is why a generation of doctors now are saying, maybe we can treat more diabetes with cooking classes instead of just throwing insulin at people. Maybe we can treat more high blood pressure by talking about sleep and stress than just throwing antihypertensive at people. Maybe we can talk about school lunch programs instead of putting every kid on Ozempic. Maybe we can talk about food as medicine and general body inflammation. Maybe we should study environmental exposures that cause cancer, not just the chemo to treat it. This is a movement now to reject this whack-a-mole medicating system that has resulted in the most medicated generation in human history. We've got to try something new, and that's what a generation of doctors now are starting to say.
Dr. McCary, you mentioned that the a huge amount of money that has been put into developing these very expensive drugs for Alzheimer's disease. Does money have the effect of increasing our blind spots, of blinkering us?
Well, I think so, because many questions in science lend themselves to important studies that need to be done, but instead we don't do the studies that need to be done. We do the studies that support the potential introduction of a new medication. And we have all, that's almost where almost all the funding goes. Take, for example, young kids now are having their upper lip frenulums cut inside the upper lip. There's one under the tongue. Even the sides of the tongue sometimes are being cut. Now, some ENT doctors tell me there may be an indication for a kid with a foreshortened tongue to cut the frenulum under the tongue in infancy. But it's rare. And that's what some people believe. They will say that the broad cutting of the parts of the tongue and mouth in infants is barbaric. It's evil. It shouldn't be done. And it's a medical dogma that has taken on a life of its own. This desperately needs a randomized controlled trial. People are making claims that doing this will reduce sleep apnea, help with the child's speech, and increase rates of breastfeeding. But on the flip side, some of that stuff doesn't make sense, and some kids don't breastfeed because they're in pain from the procedure. So this procedure is taking off like crazy. It needs a randomized controlled trial to answer the question and provide some science to the matter.
And it does sound barbaric.
I think it is. I mean, there may be rare indications, and that's what the doctors I respect tell me, but even they will tell you it's massively overused. Who's going to fund that research, though, Terry? Hmm. Big Pharma? There's no drug involved. The American Academy of Pediatrics? I don't think so. NIH doesn't fit one of their silos. So we've got to focus on the patient in healthcare, not where the pharma dollars roll in and where a bunch of old belts and suspenders professors at the NIH tell us we need to be spending our money.
Well, you know, this brings up the point that it's an insider's game.
I mean, once you become highly respected and you get a lot of grant money, and then you give out a lot of grant money, it doesn't lend itself to creative thinking. You're sort of stuck in a rut. How do we begin to change that?
Well, I think it is changing, and you're so right, Joe. So the New England Journal of Medicine, which controls the gates of scientific information for the most part, they have had a tight grip on what would be published in their journal. And do you know, there are a bunch of like-minded doctors who are friends with each other historically. Now, that's changed in the last couple of years, but just a couple of years ago, there was only one African-American on the editorial board out of 51 editors. They're mostly like-minded friends from the Harvard system in New England, and they live in a bubble. I'm not saying they're bad people. I'm saying this is what Dr. Festinger described in his cognitive dissonance writing of everyone's affirming one another, and then it turns into groupthink. So we are seeing enough people now say, hey, wait a minute, why does the New England Journal get to decide what information is released? We have Dr. Vinay Prasad and Peter Attia, Zubin Damania, so many smart doctors, some of the smartest doctors I know, who think globally about the entire body. They have impeccable credentials, and they are now challenging this old guard medical establishment. So ultimately, I'm optimistic on where we're going as a field.
You're listening to Dr. Marty McCary, Chief of Islet Transplant Surgery at Johns Hopkins University. In addition to being a surgeon, Dr. McCary is a public health researcher, striving to make healthcare more reliable, holistic, and coordinated, especially for vulnerable populations. Dr. McCary's most recent book is Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
After the break, we'll hear how groupthink can affect other professions beyond medicine.
What do you know about the evidence supporting water fluoridation?
Many older men may have low testosterone, but their doctors don't always prescribe it. Why not?
People assume that women always benefit from mammograms. What about those at low risk?
We'll also hear about policy changes that might help us identify other things that we're getting wrong.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. September is Healthy Aging Month. Why not take care of your heart and brain health by adding cocoflavanols to your daily routine for cardiovascular and cognitive support? Consider how Cocovia can be a part of your routine to age well for better years to come. More information at cocovia.com.
Today on The People's Pharmacy, we're talking about blind spots. We're all vulnerable to accepting the dogma that we learned as children or students. How can we learn how to question doctrines that may not make sense?
Our guest is Dr. Marty McCary, Chief of Islet Transplant Surgery at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. McCary leads efforts to improve the health of communities by increasing medical transparency and lowering healthcare costs for everyday businesses and consumers. Dr. McCary is the recipient of the 2020 Business Book of the Year Award for his book, The Price We Pay. Dr. McCary's most recent book is Blind Spots, When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
Dr. McCary, we've been kind of critical of some of your colleagues for this concept of groupthink, but just regular folks often fall into that trap. And I'm thinking now about treating a fever. So, you know, if a child has a temperature of 101, or even an adult for that matter, the tendency is to go for the Tylenol, the acetaminophen, or the ibuprofen, or the naproxen, Aleve. It's like we got to get that fever down to normal, and that shows that we've done something. Why have we gotten into that rut? Our grandparents didn't believe that.
It is a little comical and sad how this has become medical dogma, that if you have a fever, you need to take Tylenol or ibuprofen. And the truth is, what are we doing? The body is reacting in a way to raise the temperature to try to rid itself of whatever bacteria or viruses may be causing an infection. And that's a natural phenomena. Now, I can understand we may want to break that fever if somebody, particularly a young child, is very uncomfortable. Then we're treating the sort of comfort. But I have patients all the time tell me they have a fever, and should they take something for it? The answer is no. The study was done out at Johns Hopkins that showed kids with chickenpox who take something for it are more likely to have a longer duration of their illness. The body's not fighting it with the fever as well. And there's been other studies now suggesting there may be safety concerns with acetaminophen. At Duke, they have published a study specifically looking at its safety in neurodevelopment, and they had concerns.
One of the other topics that you address in your chapter on medical practices that are persisting, even though we don't have adequate evidence to support them, this surprised me a bit because it's been around for as long as I can remember, and that is water fluoridation. What can you tell us about that?
So here's an example of groupthink in medicine. It's been noted that fluoride is bactericidal, that is, it kills some bacteria. So it reduces the rate of cavities slightly, especially in kids that don't use good hygiene. But if it's killing bacteria in the mouth, what is it doing to the microbiome, which is a garden of billions of different bacteria that live in a harmony? So we have never asked that question before. And the truth is that while most water in the United States has fluoride in it, it's only a third of the drinking water in Canada and 3% in Europe. And we don't see radically different rates of some of these dental problems. So no one has ever stopped to ask, what are we doing to the microbiome by putting fluoride in the water system? But this is something you're not allowed to question. The CDC itself has on its website that fluoridation of drinking water is one of the top 10 public health achievements in the last century. But we may be getting it perfectly wrong. Are we open-minded to acknowledge that we may have done something at a mass scale that was wrong, that was bad for public health, when we thought it was good for public health? That is the objectivity that we need to have in science.
Well, I remember driving in the car with my parents. I wasn't driving. I was sitting in the back seat. But there'd be a radio commentator would come on and would say, fluoridation, it's a communist plot. And there was a real resistance to fluoridation. And then, of course, there was the total embrace of fluoridation. And I've become a little concerned about the effect of fluoride on the thyroid gland. I mean, we have a epidemic of hypothyroidism in this country, and nobody seems to have a good explanation for why. I'm not suggesting that fluoride is responsible, but we do need to ask these important questions. How much good is it?
and is there any harm? And sometimes I fear that that's not happening. But I would like to flip the coin on a different subject, and that is testosterone. You talked a little bit earlier about estrogen. The Food and Drug Administration just really hates the idea of older men taking testosterone if they have very low T levels. And they've made it very clear that this is terrible medical practice if a doctor were to prescribe it. Can you give us a perspective that you might have on this idea of testosterone supplementation and why it is so vilified?
Well, initially, there was a dogma that it causes prostate cancer. That has been essentially disproven. And if we look at the research in women with estrogen and ask, are there parallels with men and testosterone? They're very different situations. But in women, there is probably no medical intervention that improves the health of a population more than estrogen in postmenopausal women, reducing cognitive decline, heart attacks, Alzheimer's. If a woman falls, she is less likely to break a bone. They feel better and live on average 3.5 years longer when they take estrogen. And that's because the body is normally producing estrogen, which is involved in good health, but then stops producing estrogen around age 45 to 57. In men, there is something similar going on, but we don't understand it as well. There hasn't been good enough research. But it appears as if, when you talk to doctors who are prescribing it safely and properly, that they're seeing men not only feel stronger and lose weight, lose excess body weight, but they have higher bone density. Their blood sugar levels are a little better controlled. And because of the weight loss, people have other health benefits, including even reducing rates of sleep apnea. So are we open to the fact that testosterone replacement may have a net benefit in select men? Unfortunately, I think people have made up their mind before they look at the data, and that is the broader issue in healthcare. And so I really encourage people to be open-minded, to consider data, as Claude Bernard had said, with an objective sort of perspective, because it turns out that you mentioned the fluoride issue. When you do something, make a recommendation at mass scale, some people are going to be cynical. Some people are going to make false claims about the impact. But if we are truly objective, we may see that we've been getting certain things wrong at a mass scale.
So you've suggested that we just really can't answer the question, is testosterone a net benefit or a net harm, because we don't have enough data to make that evaluation. Is that right?
Well, I've talked to endocrinologists who prescribe it, and they say there is a net benefit in the right population of men with low T. But in the field of perimenopausal treatment with hormone replacement therapy, the data are overwhelmingly clear. And that may be a sign that even though the popular view may not recognize benefits, that it may be there in the data, and we need more studies to confirm that.
Let's talk about another topic, again, with women's health, where you are suggesting we don't have adequate data, and that would be mammograms for women who are at low risk of breast cancer.
Mammograms are one of those things in medicine you are not allowed to question because it is considered dogma. It's considered a foregone conclusion as if it's already been supported with a randomized controlled trial showing a survival benefit. It hasn't. Now, I'm not saying there's no benefit to mammography. I'm just saying that if you think there's been a randomized controlled trial that shows an all-cause survival benefit because of mammography, that study has never been done. Instead, we have other studies that suggest there is certainly a high-risk group where we conclude there's a benefit. There may be a benefit in women over 50 who are low-risk as a routine health screening. But recently, the recommendation was changed to recommend mammography for low-risk women in their 40s, starting at age 40. Now, was that based on any good randomized controlled trial data? No. So am I recommending it? I'm not. The medical establishment has run with this recommendation as if there's no mammogram that's not worthwhile. And they have issued this recommendation with such absolutism. I think people should be given the options and should be told that the level of scientific support is low. It doesn't mean it's not true, but it's not a clear-cut support. I'll tell you, you're giving radiation to ultra-low-risk women in their 40s. Are we giving them cancer? Are we giving them tremendous anxiety when there's something suspicious that ends up being nothing? And anxiety can kill people too. We've seen it just traumatize people. And there's unnecessary surgery that can result from false positives. So we need a good trial in order to make that recommendation, in my opinion. I'm not comfortable making it just because the medical establishment has run with it.
And of course, the idea of mammograms fits into another sort of broader piece of dogma, which is early cancer detection is great. And you have written about that as well. Please tell us more.
Well, early cancer detection and prevention are entirely different concepts that often get confused. And there's now a blood test where they can supposedly tell you if you have cancer and what type it is. Now, that sounds very attractive, but the reality is the data are very immature. Out of over 100,000 people who have had this liquid biopsy cancer test now, there may have been a couple cases of people whose lives were saved from early cancer detection. That's not necessarily a benefit that may outweigh the downsides of the false positives resulting in unnecessary procedures that have risks in and of themselves. Now, there may be a role for this liquid biopsy test in the future, but just because a company makes a claim that they can do something doesn't mean we should be rolling it out at mass scale. I use the test selectively if I suspect there's a cancer and we can't find it. It may be helpful in some situations. It may be helpful on a broad scale as well, but until we have the data, I'm not going to recommend an expensive test that makes hospitals rich with a lot of unnecessary scans and downstream tests and procedures.
Dr. McCary, you have a chapter titled Imagine, What Else Are We Getting Wrong? This is the last chapter in your book, and I wonder, what else are we getting wrong, and how will we determine that?
Well, we assume that GLP-1 drugs are life-saving drugs. They may shorten someone's life because there may be short-term reductions in comorbidities, but we may be accelerating frailty because these GLP-1 drugs reduce your muscle mass just like they reduce your excess fat levels. So we need to demand good data, I think, before we recommend these on such a broad scale. There are a bunch of issues that I describe, some of which we've talked about. The annual flu shot is a sort of ritual every year in medicine. Turns out that there is a universal flu vaccine that is believed to give lifelong immunity to different variants of flu as they come each year, but it's not really being supported. Big Pharma is not behind it. I think they'd probably rather have an annual shot than a lifetime shot. And we have great research that, like a lot of other great research, is just not known by the masses and even by the medical establishment. So there are nuances, and the public generally doesn't like nuances, not just in medical science, but also with war and every other topic. Just tell us who's good and who's bad, and you know I'm going to cheer for the right side. Well, it turns out there's a lot of nuance in medicine, just like there is in life.
Are there any policy changes that would help? We have about a minute.
So one of the great dogmas that has ignited the modern day peanut allergy epidemic was that avoiding peanuts early in life prevents peanut allergies. Turns out the medical establishment got it perfectly backwards when they told everyone to avoid peanuts 24 years ago. And now we know it's good for infants to have a little bit of peanut butter and milk and eggs and dogs and cats and all sorts of exposures in their infancy. And so we now are still struggling with this correcting this dogma. And to this day, the WIC program does not cover peanut butter for infants, which is really a modern-day scandal and a remnant of this dogma from the last 20 years. When medicine gets something wrong, we need to come out and correct the record as vigorously as we issued the recommendation. I think people are hungry for humility among public health officials and the medical establishment. Trust is at an all-time low. And I have found that my patients are very forgiving when I'm honest and I keep them informed in real time of where things stand or where mistakes may have been made.
Dr. Marty McCary, thank you so much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
Great to be with you, Terry and Joe. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Marty McCary. He's the chief of islet transplant surgery at Johns Hopkins University and a public health researcher leading efforts to improve the health of communities. His focus is on the design of healthcare to make it more reliable, holistic, and coordinated. Dr. McCary received the 2020 Business Book of the Year Award for his book, The Price We Pay. His most recent is Blind Spots: When Medicine Gets It Wrong and What It Means for Our Health.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. BJ Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with The People's Pharmacy.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. September is Healthy Aging Month. Why not take care of your heart and brain health by adding cocoa flavanols to your daily routine for cardiovascular and cognitive support? Consider how Cocovia can be a part of your routine to age well for better years to come. More information at cocovia.com.
Today's show is number 1400. That's quite a milestone. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com, and that's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider, including YouTube. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning. This week's podcast will have additional information on how healthcare could be redesigned and how medicine could do informed consent better.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you could sign up for our free online newsletter and get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also have regular access to information about our weekly podcast. That way, you can find out ahead of time which topics we'll be covering.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week.